Cortland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on K-B-O-O
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Right now, more than 38,500 species are threatened with extinction. That's close to 30% of all known species in the world. As human-driven climate change and habitat loss accelerate, many scientists worry we might be in the middle of a mass extinction. Back in 2019, climate activist Greta Thunberg took world leaders to task and warned of the impending mass extinction during an impassioned speech at the United Nations.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today, the scientists working hard to save our planet's endangered species. First, the red colobus monkey. The red colobus monkey is one of the most endangered primates in the world. Found in West, East, and Central Africa, the once thriving species has been decimated by overhunting. Enter Josh Linder. He's devoted his career to studying and conserving these peaceful primates. Josh is an anthropology professor at James Madison University. Josh, you study the red colobus monkey. It's one of the most endangered primates in the world. Is it threatened with extinction, really?
Yeah, there's 17 species of red colobus monkey, and they're all threatened with extinction. We measure extinction risk by looking at, you know, population size and geographic range. And of those 17 species, they're all classified as vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered. And five of them are actually critically endangered, so pretty close to extinction.
Are there places where the red colobus monkey has been in popular culture, you know, Tarzan movies or something, that we don't realize this is that monkey?
Yeah, you know, not really, and that's part of the problem. If I were to show you a picture of a gorilla or a chimpanzee, nearly everyone would say, oh, that's a gorilla or a chimp or an ape. And if I show a picture of a red colobus monkey, they just think, I guess that's a monkey, and they don't know anything more about it. So they're not in wildlife documentaries. They're not in museums. There's not a single red colobus monkey in any zoo in the world. So it's hard to get the message out about the plight of these animals.
Can you describe an adventure you had when you were actually on a research expedition looking for red colobus monkeys?
Yeah, so one of the places where I work is in Cameroon in a park called Korup National Park. It's right on the Nigerian border. And we would hike in, and every day we would just, you know, do these foot surveys in the rainforest. And the red colobus in this forest is fairly rare. It used to be a lot more common. So you have to hike for a good amount of time. And it can get quite mountainous in some of these areas. So you're hiking up and down mountains looking for these primates. They're really good at leaping. And so they occur in these very large groups often, maybe between 30 and 50, 60, 70 individuals. And they kind of crash through the trees as they move around. And usually because they occur in these large groups, once you can locate them, you can get a good view of them, even though they're really high up in the canopy.
I read that the monkeys actually have a very distinct smell. You could smell them even if you didn't see them.
Yeah, that's true. Red colobus monkeys, and my field assistants are a lot better at this than I am. they will sometimes say, hold on a minute, I smell red colobus. And it's a certain, I'm not sure if it's like a sweet smell or what, but usually soon after they say that, we will hear or see red colobus monkeys. And it's not like any other primate species, at least in the forest I work in. They won't say, oh, I smell putty nose monkey or mangabey. They'll say, I smell red colobus monkey.
What are they like?
They're really interesting animals. They're fascinating, in fact. colobus monkeys have stomachs are similar to that of cows in that they're multi-chambered, and they house a bunch of microorganisms in their stomachs and helps them to digest hard to digest foods like leaves or seeds. So colobus monkeys, like red colobus, are specialized for eating leaves. And what's really neat about them is that they don't really have thumbs. And when you think of primates, you think of grasping hands and opposable thumbs, but colobus monkeys have mostly lost their thumbs. They're greatly reduced. And they're really colorful. Different species have different bits of red on them. Some have red on their back or on their stomach or on their legs or their head. And they have really funny hairdos and interesting hairdos, depending on what species that you're studying. But when you see them, sometimes they're with other primate species and they're all calling together. And it's just kind of this wonderful symphony of primate sounds in the forest that you're surrounded by.
Can you imitate that a little?
Oh, I can make some monkey calls, yeah. So the red colobus are these high-pitched squeaking and barking, like, and then the male mangabey makes a loud call, like a chow, chow. And then the putty-nosed monkey might go, ow, ow. And so a lot of these monkey species, they have the males make these loud calls. Or long calls. So when a predator is around, they'll call, and the male will call, and then all the others might start calling, but then they realize there's some trouble, and so they might go really quiet, and then they hide, or they might flee. And red colobus monkeys, at least the one I study in Cameroon, they don't have this loud call, so they all just kind of chatter all the time. And they're a little, I don't like to say this, but they're a little dumb when it comes to being hunted. People in West and Central Africa, they hunt wild animals for meat and for money. They sell the meat in markets and bushmeat markets. And red colobus get really hammered. As I said, they occur in these large and often noisy groups, so they can be pretty easy to find. And other primate species they'll make a call and make an alarm call when a hunter comes around, and then they'll hide, and then they'll eventually flee. Red colobus monkeys don't often do that. They often just kind of stare at you. You know, I'll be finding some red colobus in the forest and they'll see me and they'll start kind of threatening me with some calls, but they don't run away. They just kind of scream at me from the top of the trees. And all I'm thinking is, run, you know, I could be a hunter. And so it's been documented across their range that hunting is one of the biggest problems for their populations.
So it's easy to catch them if you're out hunting them, but are many people hunting them? Are many people really hungry for this meat?
In West and Central Africa, hunting is widespread in the rainforests, and people tend to have a preference for wild meat or bush meat over other kinds of meat. So most wild animals, you know, bigger than a bread box or so, are hunted for their meat in West and Central Africa. And if you just stop in any village or in a town at a market, you'll see this bushmeat for sale or being consumed. So there was one time when we were looking for, we were surveying some primates in the park where I work in Cameroon, and we had to climb a mountain, and we were coming down the mountain and we got a little lost and we came down the mountain the wrong way. And all of our supplies were on the other side of the mountain. And so we got lost and it was getting dark, and we finally just found a village just outside the park. And so we kind of surprised them in the village, and you know, the people there, they're so generous and so wonderful, and they took us in, no problem. They gave us some shelter to stay in, and we said, "Look, we have no food with us," and they said, "No problem, you can have what we're eating. We'll share it with you." And it's really kind of them. And so we're in our little shelter, and they give us this stew, and I kind of start eating it, and it smells a bit different than I'm used to. And it tastes a bit different. And so I'm eating the stew, and I turn to my field assistant and I say, you know, what are we eating? And they say, well, I'm pretty sure we're eating monkey meat. And it was the kind of monkey called a drill monkey, which is actually quite endangered as well. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll eat around it then, because I don't tend to eat a lot of bush meat, and I certainly try not to eat monkey meat. But it was very kind of them. But it's just, you know, if you go into many of these villages, they're often subsisting off of wild meat.
How do we know how many red colobus monkeys there used to be to understand how endangered they are now?
Well, yeah, it's tough to say. We don't have a lot of records going too far back. So we can often just rely on sometimes what hunters tell us, and they might say, hey, 20 years ago, we would walk into the forest and not have to go very far, and we would see red colobus. And now we have to trek for 3 days, and maybe we don't even see any red colobus. And so that helps us to know that there used to be a lot more red colobus. And certainly in the past, if there were more habitat, if there was more forest, then there likely would have been more red colobus as well. And you can also count if you're surveying them in bushmeat markets. So a lot of the meat will end up in these markets in urban centers. And maybe 30 years ago, you would count a lot of red colobus monkeys in the markets. And then today you would count very few, again, suggestive that their populations have declined in the forest.
You've helped come up with a red colobus conservation action plan to try to save them.
Yes.
What do you propose?
Well, we propose a number of different things. So first priority is to do more surveys. We need to find out where these red colobus are and how abundant they are and what are their threats. In addition to that, we want to try to help improve the protected areas that are already there. So like national parks, we want to improve their effectiveness. And we need to help create new protected areas where red colobus monkeys are found. We also want to work very closely with local communities and engage them more in conservation and train people to work in conservation and give them long-term jobs. So many of these people won't engage in hunting as much, but really work more in conservation. And we want to get governments more involved. At the end of the day, it's these national governments that are going to have a huge impact. And we want to encourage them to put more funding towards conservation, and especially where red colobus monkeys are. We want to increase education and awareness of these monkeys and their habitats, both in Africa and abroad. And those are the kind of the broader strategies that we're aiming to do. And then each red colobus species will have their own different priorities related to those broader strategies.
What do you want to say to people who don't appreciate what we lose if these monkeys go extinct?
Yeah, I mean, red colobus monkeys are representative of the plight of tropical rainforests in Africa in general. I mean, they're one of many species. They're not any more special than any species. But because they're so vulnerable to hunting and because they're forest specialists, if you protect red colobus monkeys, you're going to protect so many other threatened species and threatened ecosystems. And these rainforests, they're the lungs of the earth. They're going to help us mitigate the impacts of climate change. People in these regions, these local communities, they rely on rainforests for so much of their livelihoods. And so rainforests are just some of the most important ecosystems in the world. And by protecting red colobus monkeys, you are also protecting these huge areas of rainforests in Africa.
Have other primate species, to our knowledge, gone extinct?
We haven't recorded a primate extinction in probably at least a few hundred, if not several hundred years. And there's one red colobus species called Miss Waldron's red colobus, which used to occur in Ghana and in Ivory Coast in West Africa. And in 2000, my colleagues, they did a bunch of surveys in the late 1990s looking for this monkey, and they couldn't find it anywhere. And they declared it as probably extinct, and that was in 2000. And then hunters told my colleagues, hey, I think we may have seen some red colobus, or here's a red colobus that I killed a few months back. But every time we go do surveys, we've done further surveys in mid-2000s, we can't find Miss Waldron's red colobus anymore. And so now the only place where it might be is this small forest in Ivory Coast, and it's a really swampy forest, so it's very difficult to survey. And my colleagues have been surveying there, foot surveys, but also putting up camera traps on the tops of trees where these red colobus would be to see if we can capture any footage of these red colobus monkeys. And we've captured footage of other endangered primates, but so far, Miss Waldron's red colobus monkeys, we can't find. And so the first primate extinction in the last, you know, few hundred, several hundred years might be this Miss Waldron's red colobus monkey.
Josh Linder is an anthropology professor at James Madison University. To help support the effort to protect the red colobus monkey, visit rewild.org. When the movie first came out in 1975, The Great White Shark with razor-sharp teeth and a taste for human flesh, otherwise known as Jaws, struck fear in theatergoers across the world. But for Francesco Ferretti, the movie sparked a lifelong passion for all things sharks. Now he's a marine biologist at Virginia Tech, and a few months ago he led an expedition to be the first to ever tag endangered great white sharks in the Mediterranean Sea. Francesco, you've been fascinated with sharks all your life. Did Jaws really first spark your interest?
That's very interesting. There is a lot of discussions in the field about the effect of Jaws on shark conservation, and I have to say that Jaws had a dual effect on a lot of on people. On some people, they scared them, and they scared them to death. And on other people, like including me, had a reinforcing effect on loving these animals and actually getting interested in this animal.
It's interesting because on one hand, it led to such a fear of sharks that some people argue they were hunted to death. And yet you're saying it also spawned a great love of sharks in at least a good number of biologists, right?
Definitely, it increased the interest. The first time I saw the movie was while I was doing my ninth grade or 10th grade. And I was thinking, I would like to be a marine biologist like this guy.
Right.
It was fascinating, definitely fascinating. It was frightening at that time. But the more then I knew about shark and I increased my understanding on shark, now I understand their value, I understand their importance in ocean ecosystem. So it was a priming. That movie had a priming effect, and then now I'm looking at them in a different ways with a more scientific interest.
Did you grow up on the coast of Italy near the water?
Yes, I mean, relatively speaking, yes, but no, because like in Italy, it's very you are close to the coast everywhere. It's a peninsula, so it's I was living 25 minutes from the coast. In our perspective in Italy, that was far from the coast, but now that I'm living in Blacksburg, I say we were right on the coast. I grew up in Macerata, which is a small town in the central part of Italy, a hilly region, very close to the coast, very close to the mountain, beautiful place that people call the new Tuscany.
For beauty, how does it compare to where you are now in the Blue Ridge Mountains?
I would say, so I tell my students and I tell also my colleagues that I see Virginia as what my region would have been when the Romans were there, just because it's very similar, and it's very interesting because it's in a similar position in the East Coast. It's a central state, Virginia, and my region is a central region, and the topography is very similar. So you have to substitute the forests that we have here with the cultivated land that we have. So I imagine when the Romans were settling in these areas, they were seeing a very similar environment as we are seeing right now in Virginia.
A few months ago, you were the lead investigator and scientific director of an expedition to track great whites in the Sicilian Channel. I had no idea there were great white sharks in the Mediterranean.
Yes, so a lot of people didn't realize that there were white sharks in the Mediterranean. In fact, a couple of years ago, we came out with the first synthesis of all historical sightings of white sharks in the Mediterranean Sea. And there were people tweeting me saying, I had no idea. I'm from England. I come every year in the Mediterranean Sea for vacation. I had no idea that there were white sharks in the area.
Right.
In fact, the Mediterranean white shark population is one of the sixth or seventh populations in the planet. And however, it's one of the least known. It's one of the least known for several reasons, and one of the most important at the moment is because they are very scarce. We know in the past that they were widespread in the Mediterranean Sea in any sector. They were even pests to fishers. In fact, the Austrian government during the Austrian Empire issued bounties for fishers to kill white sharks because they were deemed to be interfering with fishing operations. But now they are very scarce and they are very scattered, and we can prove this firsthand also from our expedition because of the hundreds of years of fishing exploitation and coastal development and the many threats that the Mediterranean has for shark populations.
Based on historical data, do you think that you can come up with a rough estimate of how many sharks were once either in the Sicilian Channel or the Mediterranean Sea?
Well, that's a $1 million question. Yeah. That's what we are trying to understand. We are trying to understand how many sharks are left there. We understand from our previous analysis that these sharks went down very rapidly in population abundance. With our statistics and the sightings we could collect from fishers and other ocean goers, we could come out with trend estimates saying that in the last decades, they declined by more than 80%. Now this population is critically endangered, but the scary part is that we don't know how many are left. So it's imperative that we start monitoring the last individuals that are in the area to understand more about their ecology and their biology and to promote recovery programs.
Were you able to tag any sharks this summer?
No, we were not able. This is one of the painful results of our expedition. We were ready to tag them, but we understood that this population is scarcer than what we thought. In fact, this year, for some reason, only one sighting came out from the Mediterranean. Usually you have 6, 7, 10 sightings a year. For some reason, this year, there is only one sighting coming from the region. And we actually saw that there is a lot of, firsthand, we saw the amount of fishing that is there. And it is scary because there are few individuals left. These few individuals are endangered and exposed to these fishing activities. And so we need to act very fast and we need to find these last individuals to start tracking them.
Is it true no great white shark has ever been tagged in that region?
It is true. Yeah, it is true. Wow. We would like to put the first tag on a white shark in the Mediterranean Sea for the reasons I said earlier. This population of white sharks may be very peculiar with respect to other populations because in the Mediterranean Sea there are no seals and not a lot of marine mammals. There are marine mammals, but not in the abundance that there are in other sectors. And so we think that these white sharks are selected or used to prey on other items like bluefin tuna or dolphin carcasses. And so we totally do not understand how their history of selection in the Mediterranean Sea may be very peculiar with respect to other white shark populations around the globe.
You said something so significant that even though you weren't able to tag a great white, you really saw up close with fresh eyes just how much and how vast the fishing industry is.
Yes, yes, totally.
What did you see? What did you notice that you hadn't fully grasped before?
So more than a decade ago, I published one of the first papers on the status of sharks in the Mediterranean Sea. And in that paper, we showed that multiple large predatory sharks declined to undetectable level. They were functionally eradicated by fisheries. We knew that the Mediterranean was one of the most dangerous places for sharks and other animals for fishing, one of the most exploited regions in the planet. But going there and seeing the amount of fishing and the traffic and the marine traffic related to fishing, it was a different experience because first time, in some occasions, we were trying to deploy our gears and it was difficult to understand where we could deploy our gear without interfering with gill nets in one spot or the operations of troll fishers in another spot or poor seiners in another spot. In the Sicilian Channel, especially in the Pantelleria Banks, which is in the center of the Sicilian Channel, these are international waters that are very trafficked by multiple nations in the fishing for tunas and other fish. I think there are more than 13 nations fishing in the area. So there is really no chance that if we don't do something about the conservation of these animals, we can save white sharks and other sharks.
How much do you fear that this population of great whites in the Mediterranean could become extinct?
A lot. I fear a lot. And from these expeditions were, unfortunately, we didn't detect any animal directly with eDNA, with environmental DNA. We detected they are still there, but understanding and seeing firsthand the conditions and the fishings and the threats, it makes me very worried about the status of this population. So that's why more than ever, next year we want to go again, and next year we want to increase our effort. We want to ramp up our effort and investment on being successful to find these animals. Because, I mean, the chance of losing them can be very high.
What's an easy first step, do you think, toward trying to save and grow the population of great whites in the Mediterranean?
The easy first step is understanding more about their behavior, and definitely tagging these animals will give us lots of data about their spatial movement, but also their affinity to environmental variables like temperature, salinity. So we can build models to understand where they like to live and to understand where we may need to concentrate with our conservation effort. If we can demonstrate that the Sicilian Channel is a nursery area, then it's easy to trigger an international dialogue between Tunisia, Malta, Italy, and other interested countries to perhaps design marine protected areas or fisheries restricted zones that can spare these animals, at least in their most critical life stage.
But aren't you sort of up against the tourism industry and the fishing industry?
Not really, because I would say that, first of all, having negative interaction with white sharks in the Mediterranean Sea is much less likely than winning even the most difficult and most rewarding lottery. there's no chance that you can get a negative interaction with white sharks in the Mediterranean Sea at this level of populations. So even if we increase the population of white sharks, if people understand their behavior and understand their ecology, they can make informed decision when approaching ocean use. And that's the same in many other places of the world where sharks are more abundant. If people is informed, if people understand where to go or where not to go when engaging in ocean activities, the risk of having a negative interactions with sharks is very minimal. Actually, I think having a more functional and beautiful ecosystem may even boost the tourism in the area more than what it is boosted right now. At the moment, I'll tell you this, Sarah, now whenever I go in the Mediterranean Sea and I go diving in the Mediterranean Sea, I'm extremely depressed. The Mediterranean Sea is beautiful. It's there are sparkling waters, very transparent water, very beautiful coastlines. You go underwater and there are beautiful underwater ecosystems. There are no fish. And when I say this, it makes my heart just sad, because I'm seeing all this beauty and we have sacked all the treasures of the ocean. And so I would say now that a lot of people would be much more happy to go diving in the Mediterranean Sea and seeing lots of animals and a greater biodiversity, and that would boost a lot many other ecosystem services that we can get from the ocean, from there.
Well, Francesco Ferretti, what a joy talking with you.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Francesco Ferretti is a lifetime marine biologist at Virginia Tech. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. The bald eagle has been the national bird of the United States since 1782. But just a few decades ago, it was on the brink of extinction. Brian Watts is director of the Center for Conservation Biology at William & Mary. He's been monitoring the bald eagle population in the Chesapeake Bay for 30 years. And he says the bald eagle is one of the biggest success stories in the history of conservation. Brian, for 30 years, you and the A-team have been looking for bald eagles in the Chesapeake Bay region. Tell me about the A-team. Who are you?
Yes, myself, Brian Watts, Mitchell Bird, who longtime professor and eagle biologist in the region. Mitchell's now long retired. He's 93 this year. And our pilot, Captain Fuzzo. Captain Fuzzo is retired Air Force. He's flown all kinds of planes all over since the 1950s. So we've been together for a long time surveying eagles in the lower Chesapeake.
What kind of plane do you go up in, and how low do you fly?
Yeah, we fly in a Cessna 172. When we do the primary survey, which usually happens in March, we fly up and down all the creeks and rivers at about 300 feet. We come back in April to check on how many young are in the nests, and we'll drop down to each nest at that time and look right in and count the number of young. So we drop right down to tree level.
Are there